content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Bahati Mutisia, and I'm reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazine. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Teen Vogue and The Teen Magazine. The first article is titled, How the Young Lords Fought for Healthcare Access and Won. This article is a part of Teen Vogue's OG History series, which is a series in which we unearth history not told through a white, cis-heteropatriarchal lens. This article is written by Marissa Lamar and was published February 18, 2022. It was the summer of 1969, and piles of garbage lined New York City's 110th Street. The neighborhood of East Harlem was severely lacking in sanitation services, and a group of activists, known as the Young Lords, was fed up. They snatched brooms from the sanitation department and swept piles of trash into the streets, adding old mattresses, furniture, and sinks for effect. The garbage offense had officially begun. The problem at hand was neglected trash. But the greater issue was unequal health and living conditions. The Young Lords, a revolutionary community group, turned political force and human rights organization, launched these campaigns to draw attention to inequity and poverty in the city in the 1960s and 70s. The group achieved enduring victories for healthcare access in New York City and beyond. The organization was also revolutionary in its multiracial membership and support for women and LGBTQ+ issues. Even though it was a Puerto Rican-centered group, the Young Lords' diverse membership reflected their emphasis on solidarity and shared struggle. 8 to 10% were non-Puerto Rican Latinos, and 25% were Black. Johanna Fernandez, who is an associate professor of history at Baruch College of the City University of New York and author of The Young Lords, A Radical History, told Teen Vogue. These groups were living together and experiencing the same discrimination and subpar living conditions. Denise Oliver, the first woman elected to the Young Lords leadership, and other women in the organization, pushed the group's stance on gender equality. They supported women's health by ensuring access to not just affordable care, but also safe, legal abortions, and birth control. They also worked to stop forced sterilization and experimentation on women's bodies. Beyond challenging gender roles and expectations, they welcomed LGBTQ+ members. The unique relationship between Puerto Rico and the mainland United States was central to the Young Lords' efforts. In 1917, Congress passed the Jones-Shafroth Act, which made all citizens of Puerto Rico born after 1899 U.S. citizens, and the Selective Service Act, requiring all male citizens between 21 and 30 years old to register for military service. These laws resulted in approximately 18,000 Puerto Rican men fighting for the U.S. in World War I. The government was also encouraging Puerto Ricans to come to the mainlands for jobs, which led to an influx in cities like New York, Boston, Philadelphia, and Chicago. But as these communities grew, economic resources such as housing, education, employment, and health care diminished. Even though they had served in both wars, in uniform and as part of the workforce at home, Puerto Ricans dealt with racism in addition to limited job options and lower social standing compared to their white counterparts. It was in this context that Jose Chacha Jimenez formed the Young Lords Organization, or YLO, in Chicago in 1968. The group called for Puerto Rico independence, participated in local politics, and worked in solidarity with colonized and working class people everywhere. The YLO inspired young Puerto Rican activists in their late teens and early 20s to travel from New York to meet Jimenez and form a New York chapter that would reflect their experiences in the city. Five men led the group: Juan Gonzalez, Felipe Luciano, Pablo Yoruba Guzman, David Perez, and Juan Fi Ortiz. This New York chapter ultimately split ties with Chicago and created the Young Lords Party in 1970, a group committed to working at the grassroots level and connecting with their communities. The first thing they did was hit the streets of East Harlem, also known as Spanish Harlem for its predominantly Latinx population, and ask their neighbors what they thought the biggest local problem was. The responses were more straightforward than they expected. Fernandez told Teen Vogue, "People were worried about trash. Garbage was an epic problem in New York and in poor communities in particular. The Department of Sanitation didn't have the capacity or organization to address it. Though seemingly simple, the garbage offensive was a visual representation of a larger systemic problem. By focusing on these basic needs, the Young Lords showed those they were advocating for that they truly cared for and understood them, reflecting the true power of their movement." One of their largest and most visible campaigns targeted the Bronx rundown Lincoln Hospital. The building was overrun by rats, the hospital was overcrowded, and children were getting lead poisoning while receiving care. In addition, it was, according to historian Laurel Lefty, where medical residents trained while treating poor people of color, leading residents of Lincoln's catchment area to refer to the institution as the butcher shop. The Young Lords staged a 12-hour-long takeover of the hospital and achieved concrete successes for the community, which Lefty described as one of the first patients' Bill of Rights in history, the first recorded public medical trial after an incident of malpractice, the creation of an innovative acupuncture clinic, and the eventual construction of a new Lincoln Hospital after many years of empty promises. Many members had the experience of interpreting and translating for their parents, who had arrived to the mainland after World War II. This gave them strong communication and negotiation skills, which they used to great effect. They led grassroots efforts, organizing marches, and pressuring elected leaders while also gaining media attention, a major part of their success. They leveraged TV to reach beyond their numbers, Fernandez told Teen Vogue. They identified a problem affecting their community and created a narrative around it. This personalized oppression by naming specific protagonists and villains. They then pair the narrative with direct action events that played well on the evening news and helped them win over the public and new supporters. Beyond Chicago and New York, groups formed in Philadelphia, Connecticut, New Jersey, Boston, Milwaukee, California, and even Puerto Rico. The Chicago branch of the Young Lords also joined the Rainbow Coalition, an alliance of poor Latinos, Black people, and white people. This membership created a close connection with the Black Panthers. The Young Lords' fashion in particular closely reflected that of the Panthers. Members donned berets, military fatigue, and combat boots, sporting afros and bell-bottoms. They visually reflected the political pulse of the movement, and you knew exactly what they stood for when you looked at them, Fernandez told Teen Vogue. It meant that these young people stood against colonial rule and the white supremacy that justified colonial rule. Though they projected a tough image, the New York Young Lords included some of the best and brightest of the city's high school students, as journalist Ed Morales describes in The Nation. Many were first-generation college students. The Young Lords dissolved in the mid-1970s after being plagued by infighting and COINTELPRO, the FBI's secret surveillance program designed to undermine leftist activist groups. Yet, the organization's impact endures. Their campaigns led to the passage of relevant legislation in their communities, like anti-lead poisoning legislation. But they also brought national attention to the issues that impacted their communities most, particularly increased health resources for communities of color. The young lords focused on things like improving trash collection, bringing tuberculosis testing to their neighborhoods, and safeguarding women's productive rights. The young lords were revolutionary in their style, diversity, and overall impact. They led campaigns of direct action to bring attention to injustice and convince others to work together to resolve it. And the direct action tactics they used, like highly visible building occupations and marches, are still used by contemporary activists in the Black Lives Matters and climate movements. Today, as in the 1960s, the streets of New York City were littered with trash. With some sanitation workers refusing to get vaccinated, garbage is piling up, and the pandemic has brought into sharp focus the great gap in access to medical care in communities of color. But the young lords' history shows undeserved groups a way forward for taking their power back. The next article is also from Teen Vogue, and it's titled Amanda Gorman on the Poetry Renaissance, Lifting Up Artists and the Power of Girls of Color. This was written by Varsha Sharma and published February 17, 2022. When I first met Amanda Gorman, she had just turned 21. As I was backstage at the Women in the World Summit, an annual event held in New York dedicated to elevating women and girls' voices in the areas of politics, culture, and more. I was there to interview some of the speakers, with names like Hillary Clinton and Oprah on the illustrious list. Amanda had opened the summit with a special spoken word performance that included music and choreographed dancers. The effect in full was spectacular, but it was Amanda who was absolutely arresting. Backstage, I stopped in my tracks, pausing on whatever prep work I was doing to watch Amanda on stage, and I listened. She was captivating. Millions of people who saw her at Joe Biden's presidential inauguration last year went through a similar experience. Completely, unexpectedly, not really knowing who this young poet was before she took the stage, and absolutely enamored after. In my case, it did not hurt that when I met Amanda backstage, she was as effervescent in person as you'd expect, incredibly kind and enthusiastic about her work. Amanda has the kind of voice that makes you sit up and listen, the kind of voice that inspires, even in an era of cynicism, grief, hurt, and loss. Amanda has always had the voice, but she readily admits she didn't always know how best to use it. That's why, a few years later, at the still very young age of 23, it's amazing to see Amanda now using her massive platform to help other young people find and amplify their own voices. After skyrocketing to viral and global fame after Biden's inauguration and the thrilling recitation of her poem, The Hill We Climb, Amanda, the youngest inaugural poet in U.S. history, was inundated with offers and opportunities. She was on the cover of Vogue in May 2021 and a co-chair of the Met Gala in September, along with Billie Eilish, Naomi Osaka, and Timothée Chalamet. Days before she took to the steps of the Met in a beautiful blue dress inspired by the Statue of Liberty, Amanda also announced her first major multi-year partnership, one with Estée Lauder, the global beauty brand. Together, they announced a $3 million initiative called Writing Change, with the main focus of advancing literacy as a pathway to equality, access, and social change. Now, a few months later, Amanda and Estée Lauder companies have announced that five U.S.-based organizations will receive funding from the initiative: the American Library Association, Girls Write Now, We Need Diverse Books, Write Girl, of which Amanda is an alum, and McGizzy, which focuses on Native American youth. The five grant recipients were chosen based on their ability to impact and organize for young and diverse communities, among their other key factors. Estée Lauder Companies hosted a virtual town hall on February 7th, where Amanda joined more than 5,000 employees worldwide to announce the writing change grantees before the news was made public. I was invited to hear Amanda's conversation about the need for literacy change and her hope for the future, along with William P. Lauder, CEO Fabrizio Frida, and Executive Group President Jane Hertzmark-Houdis, who Amanda counts among the people who inspire her. In an exclusive interview with Teen Vogue, Amanda explains why this mission is so personal for her, as well as the importance of these specific organizations. We also discuss the alarming trend of current book bans and burnings in the U.S., why she thinks young women of color are particularly strong storytellers, and what her whirlwind last year has been like. Versha Sharma. I'm looking at this list of grantees. First, the American Library Association. What that brings to mind is the fact that we're seeing a national wave of censorship, even book burning, becoming a thing again. It's perhaps not surprising given the political and social climate, but it's still very alarming. I'd love to hear your take on why it's important to preserve these works and fight back against it. Amanda Gorman. I think you really are spot on in highlighting an issue that we're seeing now more than ever, which is a censorship of books. When you kind of look at it, these are works that are actually that we actually need and that we should be analyzing and investigating. And so I think the whole issue of access to literacy is, in itself, access to literature. Who am I allowed to read? Who am I allowed to question? Who am I allowed to emulate and imitate? And the more that we limit that, the more that we change and imprison the next great voices of American youth. The more that we change and imprison the next great voices of American youth. So I think that it's super important that we have a conversation around literacy that is also deeply connected to making sure that we are preserving the windows and mirrors that young leaders deserve to have. Versha. This generation, your generation, is more socially conscious and minded than any generation before. Why is it always young people who are actually pushing for progress? Amanda. I think one of the things that comes to mind is I think young people, we often have the most to lose by inaction. So it's often not recognized. For example, I hear a lot from older people, which is, you have your whole life ahead of you, you know? You have so little to lose. The stakes are so low. And I think for the young people, we actually see it as the flip side of that, which is, if I have my whole life ahead of myself, then that means that fighting for today is actually safeguarding my tomorrow. That I'm actively trying to shape the world in which I'm going to spend the rest of my life living. If anything, that means the stakes are incredibly high, because it's no longer solely just about descendants or an abstract sense of the future, but a very real, intimate, personal feeling of peril. And so, for example, I think of my mother's generation, who I think was told a lot, change the world. And for my generation, we're told, save the world. When you think about it, that's two entirely very different stakes that we're dealing with. And so I think one of the things that Gen Z has that makes it so special is not just being young, which means we're restless, young, scrappy, and hungry, as Hamilton might say, but also that we have this sensation of having to be the saviors of ourselves and the saviors of tomorrow. Versha. I have to imagine that so many brands have reached out to you in the last year now, but you chose to partner with Estee Lauder on this. It seems because you felt like it was something meaningful? Amanda. Absolutely, yeah. I think one of the things that was compelling about Estee Lauder companies out of so many other different aspects was one, being founded by an entrepreneurial American businesswoman who was really ahead of her time, as well as their own legacy. Historically, they have as a brand and as a company. Also, the fact that so many of their employees are women. All of that in total made me feel that I was getting into partnership with a company from which its backbone and DNA is really about uplifting women and being at the cutting edge of what's possible in beauty. And that's really what drew me into it. Versha, obviously you yourself have been passionate about poetry for some time now. Everything that's happened in your career last year, the Super Bowl, the inauguration, has put poetry in a spotlight it hasn't been in for some time. What's your take on that landscape for art and poetry is right now? Amanda, I personally believe that we are experiencing a poetry renaissance, and I know so many people consider me to be the face of that, but I honestly just consider myself as a facet or small part of what's making that happen and possible. I think there is such exciting work being done by young, marginalized authors and poetry artists. That means that all of a sudden we're experiencing a breadth of lyricism that's really exciting for not just the country, but the world. I think often it can be seen as, oh, Amanda Gorman, she did the inauguration, she did the Super Bowl, and that's what poetry means. I actually think it goes way beyond that, that I myself have been coming up and growing and developing in a time where poetry is being revisited, not as the arena of dead old white men, but a power that we can all tap into. Versha. Probably nobody could have anticipated quite what the last year has been like. What about the response to your inaugural poem and everything else since? If anything, has it surprised you? Have you been surprised by the incredible reception you received? Amanda. Oh, I've been nothing but surprised. There has been nothing about this year where I said, I expected that. I think I'm always flying by the seat of my skirt, as it were. I remember a few weeks before the inauguration, Oprah texted me, and she was like, this is going to change your life. I was like, yeah, sure. And then it happened, and I went, oh, this is what you meant. I could never have been able to imagine this type of response, because it's not something that I think we've seen historically before, because there's only been a very small handful of inaugural poets, and I'm one-third of that surviving legacy, and so I didn't have much data to draw on. So I am constantly surprised. My friends will send me photos of murals that have my face on it, or bookstores that have my books in front of the window. Just seeing the way that poetry can touch so many different spaces, even internationally, I'm personally always blown away by what I see being done with my work. For example, in Germany. I don't speak German. I've never had the deep honor of visiting that country, but that is a nation that has really, in so many bookstores, it made not just my poetry, but poetry by the people prevalent. Versha. This is also not surprising, but credit to you for remaining focused on the initiatives that are important to you, despite whatever social media or viral frame you've experienced. A cornerstone of this initiative is focused on girls of color. Tell me why that group and community in particular is so crucial to the arts and vice versa. I think girls and girls of color are important to the world, not just the arts. I think what makes us so essential to storytelling is that it's often marginalized people who create language by which we can better imagine ourselves. It's kind of by seeing the darkest capabilities of mankind that then inspire creators of color to be all the more audacious with their creative powers. And in that same vein, to me, it's not surprising that often the most cutting edge and gripping art that we see or buy is by far by women and people of color and other marginalized groups as well. And so I think if we're going to have a conversation, which is necessary, about who we should be passing the mic to, it always has to center around who has been kept from the table, who has been kept from the stage. For so long, especially with the platform that is offered by poetry, it's been something that's been gated off to people. People who are not cisgender, not heterosexual, not white, not male, not pale, and not old. And I just love seeing the gate open to different places that we're really in need of. Versha. Which brings me to my next question. Obviously, there's been some great progress on this score. What has the progress been like from your perspective, and how much more do you think we have to achieve? Amanda. I feel a lot of progress in many different ways. For example, I'm the daughter of an English teacher, and so I'm always trying to be aware of the types of writers that are being taught in the classroom and where the gaps are. Something that was exciting for me about having The Hill We Climb taught in the classroom was not necessarily, oh, look, everybody gets to kind of celebrate my work. But instead, the idea that there might be a child in that classroom who has a speech impediment or a disability or is of color or is female, and being able to see themselves represented in literature. I had many different classes growing up where I wasn't presented with any authors who looked like me, who sounded like me, came from areas that I came from. And so I think that the idea that classrooms are ready to teach about young Black female poets is really exciting to me, particularly because it means there's so many other authors that we can be looking at as well. For the progress that still needs to happen, I think there's a lot further that we have to go. Writing Change came out of that understanding that we're not done yet. I think that also informs the pillars that we're centralizing the initiative around: access, advocacy, and artistic expression. Access being one of the most foundational and those areas that the world still needs to see a lot of progress on, about making literacy available and accessible to everyone. I want to ask about another organization that's on the grantee list, McGizzy, which is dedicated to Native American youth. Another positive trend that we've seen in media and pop culture is an increase in Indigenous representation. Why is that important to you and this initiative? Amanda, one of the things that made McGizzy really compelling to us to fund was, one, you have the aspect of working closely with Native American youth who are often underserved when it comes to having access to literary resources, but also the fact that the program is working in a Midwestern state, Minnesota. Often, geographically, those types of areas get looked over for funding and skipped over in favor of coastal organizations. This organization has all the intersections of making sure that they are reaching the most in-need youth of their community, while doing it in a really creative and inspiring way. And so, hands down, we had to fund them. That's such a great way of framing it. When people talk about investing in communities, they don't necessarily think of art as essential. Why is this kind of investment actually essential to building communities and community resources? I think one of the core engines of democracy, civilization, society is, in and of itself, literacy. I think we're seeing that in terms of misinformation, censorship, siloed thinking, that one, when people's ability to think critically, to read, to understand is diminished, it opens the floodgates for the worst demons of hate and intolerance to reign. I don't think it's any surprise that if you look at, for example, ancient Greece, which in many ways is considered the birthplace of modern democracy, if you look at a place like Athens, what made it so special is a nation state wasn't just democratic thinking, but its commitment to the art and to storytelling. That is to say, the state of our nation is only so strong as the state of our storytellers, and the more that we treat them as essential voices in society, the better our society will be for it. All right, well, we've come to the end of today's episode of Teen Magazine. Please be sure to listen next time. This content is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening.